the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is...
Don't you want the Republicans to wake up? The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading today's in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a powerful two-parter. First up, Andy Worthington, the British journalist and author of the Guantanamo Files. He'll talk to us about the controversial swap of five Taliban prisoners from Gitmo for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl being held captive in Afghanistan. A lot of important backstory details coming from Andy Worthington. And in our second segment today, attorney John Eisenberg returns to our program to talk about the plight of inmates at Guantanamo who've been cleared for release, but no progress toward that goal. And some of them maintain hunger strikes as the only way of expressing their objection and their outrage to their continuing detention. And it's an ugly process as force feeding by the U.S. government continues on as many as three dozen of the prisoners at Guantanamo. And Judge Gladys Kessler, in district court in Washington, is clearly anguished over the mistreatment of these prisoners by the government, including the continued forced extractions from their cells and the very painful process of inserting and reinserting the force-feeding tubes. I want to thank the people who make my podcast possible by subscribing, including Justin Keene, who listens all the way from Singapore and recently signed up for an annual subscription. Thank you, Justin. Also, a few miles away, Gary Kane in Fairlawn, New Jersey, recently took out a new annual subscription. Gary, your bonus gifts are on the way. Thank you both. You could be next to support the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I hope you'll do so. Come on over to my website, peterbcollins.com. Click on the link under my picture that says sign up. You can choose from $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever is comfortable for you. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers get the bonus gifts like the Red Flag Rock and Roll CD from John Dist and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Thanks for your support, those of you who support us, and thanks to everybody who listens here at peterbcollins.com. First up in this two-part special in-depth interview podcast about Guantanamo and the distraction over Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's release and the trade for five Taliban members, we turn to Andy Worthington once again, the British journalist who has done exhaustive coverage of America's prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He is the author of the Guantanamo Files, and he continues to maintain his blog about Guantanamo and the individuals who've been incarcerated there at andyworthington.co.uk. As always, Andy, great to talk with you.
Pleasure.
And Andy, you and I were lamenting a bit before we started the recording here that once again, Guantanamo is getting news coverage, but not for the reasons that you and I would wish.
Yeah, well, absolutely, Peter. I mean, you know, last year, you know, Guantanamo resurfaced in the news, and there was genuine widespread interest and indignation about the situation at Guantanamo when the men went on a hunger strike, a prison-wide hunger strike, and globally the media was paying attention. NGOs, senior political figures around the world, even within the United States as well, there was indignation. You know, we had 1 million people who signed petitions calling for the closure of Guantanamo. That was unusual, I think, Peter. I mean, it came out of a terrible situation that the men were in such despair that they were on a hunger strike.
And Obama held that unusual speech that was interrupted by Medea Benjamin. Yeah. And he actually honored her heckling and the message that she so artfully delivered. And people may remember the heckling more than the message. But the president was actually begging to be permitted to shut down Guantanamo. That was the takeaway I got from that talk.
Yeah. Well, he's always been very eloquent about why Guantanamo is such an abomination and needs closing. But he won't, you know, actually back that up with what's necessary in actions. But, you know, I think that was the only time that I can think of in recent memory when the coverage of Guantanamo involved people looking at the place and focusing on the issue of, oh yeah, we are doing something terrible here and we need to bring it to an end. And that means we're going to have to find a way of releasing prisoners. Apparently, over half of these guys we don't even want to hold. You know, and when we've done that, we also need to make sure that the place is closed down once and for all, and that we can look back on this time and make a promise that we will no longer engage in indefinite detention without charge or trial, extraordinary rendition, torture, all of the appalling things that Guantanamo stands for and that still it stands for, you know, but we're miles away from that. What happens instead is that, you know, Guantanamo disappeared from the media's consciousness yet again, and now it's come back in the most appalling manner with disgraceful behavior, I have to say, from Republicans and from some members of President Obama's own party about this prisoner swap. With the media picking up on it in the most disgraceful manner as well, where they're chasing headlines, partly, but as so often on Guantanamo, they don't care what the truth is. What they're looking for is shock horror stories, and you know we've got this maelstrom of nonsense going on at the moment.
Well, and we have this Nancy Grace mentality, and I know you visit the U.S. occasionally. I'm not sure if you've had the displeasure of observing this cable news show, but Nancy Grace every night picks an obscure criminal event, demonizes and presents a one-sided account of the crime that occurred, and before the commercials are finished at the end of the half hour, she essentially has convicted this person before a trial has ever been held. And so we have an entire nation of Nancy Graces who have decided that Bo Bergdahl was a deserter and therefore should have just been left to languish and die in Afghanistan. And the same people who are now virulently attacking the president for, you know, negotiating with terrorists and a bad deal with the Taliban, many of them supported the release of Bergdahl and efforts to attain it when they thought Obama wasn't doing anything about it and they could gain political advantage.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it is nakedly opportunistic and cynical, most of the responses to what's going on. You know, here's an American soldier where, you know, if you stand back and look at it objectively, I think most people would generally say the obligation is that we try and get our guys back. But like you say, what's happened with Bo Bergdahl instead is that now he's being judged as guilty without having had a trial. That sounds very familiar because mm-hmm. that's exactly what's happening at Guantanamo. And we really do legitimately have people on this basis saying, no, we should just have abandoned him. I mean, what, you know, what's going on? This is without even bringing in the Guantanamo issue and the Taliban prisoners. Mm-hmm. This is just on the basis of the treatment of Bo Bergdahl.
And Andy, if I may ask you to help us, you have the benefit of an offshore perspective. And it was just a week before the Bergdahl swap was announced that the president went to Afghanistan on a surprise visit, and then returned to announce a whole new plan for the U.S. withdrawal, which pushes back the timeline by at least 2 years, and it allows the continuation of our control of the Parwan prison, which is perhaps worse than Guantanamo, because Obama hasn't even identified the individuals who are being held there indefinitely without charge or trial. And in the United States, there was zero reaction to Obama's new plan for the exit from Afghanistan. No criticism from the same Republicans who are micromanaging the Bergdahl case, in the media, and not a peep from Democrats who have just passively accepted whatever Obama decides to do about Afghanistan. The American people have no investment there emotionally, and it's as if it's just whatever. Okay, but now we are force fed. I regret that I said that because of what's going on at Guantanamo and what we'll discuss in our next segment. The American people are being propagandized with this sideshow about Bo Bergdahl, when the bigger issue of our occupation of Afghanistan is simply, not controversial.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, and I must admit, Peter, I also haven't looked into the story in enough detail really to discuss it about what happened with President Obama's visit. What I do know is that, the discussions of the Taliban prisoners who've been released as part of this prisoner exchange, the way that their dangerousness has been exaggerated is one thing. But also, to be behaving as many lawmakers have and as many pundits have, as though when you're winding down at the end of an armed conflict, of a war, you are not allowed under any circumstances to negotiate with the people that you've been fighting with, that no steps must be taken to release any of these people. What it seems to me is that the terrible illusion of the Bush years, that America now holds people without charge or trial literally forever, has hit the reality of actually we've been holding guys essentially as prisoners of war, even though we may not have labeled them as such. And now the war is coming to an end, and now the messy business begins of who gets released under what basis, and how are we going to go about this. And it seems very clear to me that the release of these Taliban prisoners, though explicitly in exchange for Bo Bergdahl, was also part of this process of preparing for, Afghanistan in the future, and for having to finally discuss, negotiate, talk with, do things with the Taliban. But we're not hearing that.
Part of it is that we don't have any resolution, that there hasn't been a ceasefire. There hasn't been any significant peace talks, at least not publicly, that have led to even a stand down. And so it's not a clean end. We are simply leaving and we didn't win. We're not actually admitting that we lost. And so the mechanics and the chemistry of that make it very difficult, as you've just suggested, to handle the end game, which is not pretty.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's exactly because of the denial of these people that they've been enjoying having their nasty little game that they've been playing for the last 12 years of holding people without rights and without having to justify what they're doing. Mm-hmm. In the real world, we have someone like John Bellinger, who's a legal advisor to the Bush administration, saying, well, actually, the point is not far off where Taliban prisoners are going to have to be released by us because we have no right to hold them. When the conflict is wound down, we lose the legitimacy of holding them. This is what we're not hearing very much about this, are we, Peter? Because actually the issue now is, okay, well, this is interesting, because how many of the men that are held in Guantanamo, not the poor guys who are cleared for release, who don't get released because they're not significant enough, but how many of the other guys, there's about 60 of them, that the U.S. is having a slow review process of, the men they said they wanted to carry on holding because they're too dangerous to release, or that they were going to try until their trial system collapsed, essentially. how many of these guys can they hold on the basis that they can they carry on holding on the basis that they had something to do with Al-Qaeda? How many of them were actually just involved in a military context with the conflict in Afghanistan, which, you know, they should never have been held for this long, but we're about to see the justification for holding them on this basis evaporate, and yet no one wants to talk about it.
Well, but Andy, you underestimate, or to use a Bush phrase, you misunderestimate the depth of arrogance and the concept of American exceptionalism, which the president just fully, he gave it a big bear hug in his speech at the West Point commencement. And I'm one of those people who bristles at this notion of American exceptionalism, as if we're better than everybody else in the world. And that exceptionalism is what drives the mentality that we can not only keep Guantanamo open, but that we can illegally detain people there out of just the stated and unproven allegation that they pose an ongoing threat. And you're correct that technically, with the so-called end of hostilities, the president's power to detain these people appears to go away. But there is no interest in rational, objective, and fact-based operations on the part of most of our elected leaders.
No, absolutely, Peter. And that is, you know, the dismaying thing about the fact that, you know, here we are talking about the five Taliban guys who've been released, who weren't cleared for release. You know, no process, they hadn't gone through a process that ended up with the presidential task force that made its, that was working in 2009 and made its report in January 2010 about whether men should be prosecuted, continue to be held, or whether they should be released. These guys were not cleared for release. But, you know, we have all these other men who have been cleared for release, 78 of them. 75 of them were approved for release by the task force. Three others have been approved for release in recent months by the periodic review boards that President Obama established. And yet none of these guys are going anywhere. And everyone is to blame for that, Peter. I know that I have discussed this with you before, and I still maintain that the responsibility for holding people at Guantanamo that the U.S. says it doesn't want to hold, the most disgraceful message you can send to the world when you're depriving people of their liberty. Hey, we said these guys could go, but actually, no, we're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. The responsibility for that lies with Congress, certainly, for all the obstacles that they've raised, with the judiciary for decisions that have been taken that have made things very difficult, but also with President Obama. And no one has been prepared to make a move on this to say the longer that we are holding people that we said we didn't want to hold, the more disgusting and disgraceful that is. And the message that we send to the world is that we have disdain, complete disdain for any notions of the law, justice, and fairness.
Now, Andy, I want to take a little sidebar here, because it was a year ago that the president gave his speech and renewed his commitment to empty the prison for the purpose of closing it. And since then, only a dozen men have been released, only one is since January 1st of 2014. And last week, there was an interesting story in the New York Times relating that Susan Rice, now the National Security Advisor, had sent a fairly stern letter to Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, demanding that he file biweekly reports with the White House on the progress toward releasing prisoners from Guantanamo. And while traveling, Hagel responded to this and said, well, you know, it's only me. Congress invested the authority in the Secretary of Defense to certify that these people should be released and don't pose an ongoing danger to the United States. And what he made very clear is that he relishes that power and that he's going to take his sweet-ass time. And this comes against the backdrop, as we'll discuss in our second segment, of Diab, the prisoner who continues a hunger strike and is now being the federal courts first said that to stop force feeding, then said to resume force feeding. It's really tragic. But here's a man who has been cleared for release, and Chuck Hagel doesn't care that he is on a hunger strike and may die, and that the brutality of the force feeding continues. And that, to me, is a grisly depiction of the politics of Guantanamo today?
Well, absolutely, Peter. And, you know, for the benefit of listeners who aren't up to speed on this story, this is a Syrian man who's long been cleared for release, is in despair because he hasn't been released, so has been on a hunger strike. And because he's been on a hunger strike, he's been force-fed. So, you know, he managed to get a judge to look at his case, and his force-feeding was temporarily suspended. But the judge then said, well, look, I can't actually keep this suspension in place because the guy might die, and we don't want him to die. But what she has done is order the government to produce videos, which his lawyers found out about his force-feeding. He's one of six men that President Mujica of Uruguay has said he is prepared to offer new homes to. There are three other Syrian guys in Guantanamo who can't be sent home because of the mess that Syria's in. There's the last Palestinian in Guantanamo who can't be sent home because you can't go home to Palestine from Guantanamo because you have to go through the Israelis and they won't let anyone back. All the Palestinians have been rehoused in other countries. There's also a Tunisian man. He's offered to take all of these guys. So as you say, you know, we have Chuck Hagel not bothering to do anything with the power that he has. And we have President Obama not doing anything with the power that he has, because he is in a position to do something about this as well. Nobody else can do it. Whatever obstacles are raised by Congress, it's not in their power to say, actually, let's get these guys released. I think it's disgraceful, Peter, you know, and I don't know what we are to do about it. You know, we seem to have been in this position for such a long time that nothing that we can do or that the prisoners can do exerts sufficient pressure on President Obama to actually do what is necessary and to release, you know, all these people that the U.S. said it didn't want to hold. 12 men in a year? Okay, well, you know, that was better than the previous years. But it doesn't look good when there are these 78 guys who want to go home. And let's not forget, the majority of those men are Yemenis. And within the U.S. establishment, pretty much everybody is sitting on their hands over Yemen and going, yeah, well, we don't think the security situation is sufficient in Yemen, is sufficiently safe in Yemen for us to release anybody there. It's like, why do you pretend that you have a review process then? Really? You know, there are two things the government shouldn't have done. President Obama shouldn't have said he was going to close Guantanamo, and he shouldn't have said we're going to have a review process to decide whether we're going to hold you or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now it turns out that just being Yemeni is sufficient for you to stay in Guantanamo for the rest of your life. What a disgrace that is. And how sad that most of the American people don't know, and so many of those that, if they do know, they don't care.
And Andy, when this story first broke on Monday of this week, so the announcement was made on Saturday, there was reaction on Sunday. Monday was my first podcast, and one of the things I said, regrettably, is that I fear that this sequence of events is going to produce the sideshow and the firestorm that keeps Guantanamo open perhaps perpetually. I mean, well beyond the Obama presidency, to say the least. And I do have to say that while I support the president's decision in this case, the manner in which it was handled and this failure to notify Congress in some form under the restrictive law that Congress has passed does leave the president vulnerable, because domestically there are many other issues where he has operated unilaterally, particularly on the health care reform. And while I don't agree with the way Republicans have obstructed the president on that narrow issue, they're correct that he has changed elements of the law without going back for an amendment from the Congress that passed it. And so tensions are building. And unfortunately, I do fear that this backlash is going to have the consequence of actually extending the life cycle of the prison at Guantanamo.
Well, I think it looks bad at the moment, Peter. And, you know, I'm hoping it will blow over in some ways. And I think it will blow over in some ways, but that will still probably leave us in a position where, you know, where there is an increase in opposition in the Congress. I actually, you know, it seems to me that President Obama and the administration heard that Bo Bergdahl, you know, that appeared to be very ill, had to act very swiftly on it, and therefore, you know, he used powers that, as far as I can see, he has, regardless of what Congress says he has and doesn't have.
Well, and Andy, here's another kind of zoom out situation where we see the members of Congress trying to micromanage the president on a matter of clemency, compassion, if I can put it that way. And the president has unfettered pardon powers. He could pardon Bo Bergdahl if he's ever accused of something. But they want to micromanage freedom and liberty and the protection of life. But they don't have any interest in reining in the president's claimed authority to target individuals, American and others, to be killed by drone strikes on the basis of metadata, where a cell phone happened to be located, and all kinds of shaky intelligence. So once again, we see the political firestorm is based on minor issues, when the bigger issue of the president's claimed authority to kill people is just a yawn.
Yeah, and some of this, I think, is about party politics, and you know, some of it isn't. I don't know where Dianne Feinstein is coming from with her being upset about it.
But ego, it's her ego. She thinks that the president should have asked her so that she could throw a little hissy fit and say no.
Yeah. But you know, with some of the Republicans, Peter, I have to say that if the Republicans happened to be in charge at the moment, and it was a Republican president, and I imagine that a lot of the same things that are happening would be happening. I don't think we would have had half of the hysteria that we're having. I think a lot of it is because it's Obama. A lot of it is because he's a Democrat. It's not the whole story, but in some ways, I think it is. If President Republican was doing exactly the same things, I don't think he'd be getting the same amount of flack from his own party.
Mm-hmm.
I
do think that's fair, and it is part of this ongoing obstructionist effort in the Congress. And of course, we're in the middle of an election year, the midterms, and so the posturing goes to even greater depths.
The midterms are worrying, I think. I mean, the thing is that Democrats, and I mentioned yet again Senator Carl Levin, but it was not just him. Others involved in persuading lawmakers last year to ease some of their restrictions on the transfer of prisoners in the National Defense Authorization Act. And I can see that, a lot of backsliding happening on that. But, I have to say that I'm sure behind the scenes, those same people are pushing to achieve what needs to be achieved, to end up in a position where we can actually close Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
But if it all starts going wrong in Congress, then, we're looking at one man in particular who's going to have to do something about it, which is President Obama. There is within the legislation the ability, he has the ability to sidestep Congress if he regards it as being in the national security interest of the United States. Now, I don't even know, Peter, whether, on what basis exactly the president didn't consult Congress. My understanding is that he did that in a military sense as the commander-in-chief, and that he was under those terms, but it may be that actually he decided that he wasn't going to have Congress be able to obstruct him. I think the waiver in the legislation is very, very important, but he won't use it. He's the only time that he's gone against Congress, however he's done it, has been in the case of these five guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, over the next, before his presidency finishes, if he's not going to get support from Congress, I want to see him. And I want to see the American people demand that he does something as the president to get people out of Guantanamo, to make steps towards the closure of that prison. And obviously we will all keep trying to exert that pressure, because he has a legacy and presidents care about their legacy. And frankly, a big black mark against President Obama, if the prison stays open in the same mess that it is, hey, this is the guy who came into office promising to close this abomination. And you know what? He failed. And all the time he bleated on about how it was Congress's fault. And sure, let's not let Congress off the hook, because lawmakers have behaved appallingly. And we can see now how appallingly they can behave when Guantanamo comes into sight. But, the president has got to do what he said he was going to do, really. Or it's going to be it's going to be a black mark against him in the history books.
Yeah. Well, I would like to see him follow through, but as you have noted, he's been extremely timid and unwilling even to use these waiver powers that Carl Levin inserted into the defense acts that put restrictions on the movement of prisoners from Guantanamo. Andy, I wanted to get the benefit of your deep study of the individuals held at Guantanamo and give our listeners some thumbnail reactions on the five Taliban men who have been now sent to Qatar, where we're told they'll spend a year, and then it's not quite clear to me what their level of freedom will be after that. But I had the opportunity to interview Anand Gopal earlier this week. He's the independent journalist. He has a new book out, which brings voices of Afghans, rarely heard in the United States, to the picture. And I asked him for his comments, and one of the things that he noted is that of the five, at least three or four of them were double-crossed. These were actual Taliban leaders who, when they saw the shifting landscape in Afghanistan, they tried to change sides, like the warlords that we permitted to change sides through cash payments, and we continue to support as we prop up the occupation there. And so let's start with Fazel, Mullah Mohammed Fazel. He was a deputy minister of defense. He was the army chief of staff under the Taliban when it was the legitimate government of Afghanistan. He is accused of human rights violations and particularly related to the Hazaras. But Gopal told me that he tried to surrender to the warlord Dostum, and it was Dostum who handed him off to the Americans in a double cross.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and also Nurullah Nuri as well, who was seized at the same time and is also, you know, a military commander in the Taliban, allegedly implicated in serious human rights abuses and the murder of Hazara civilians. They did surrender. They surrendered to General Dostum, who is the former Russian-backed Northern Commander, Northern Alliance commander who became a U.S. ally. But you know, it's not a very savory character.
Mm-hmm.
He held them for quite some time. He had them basically under his personal house arrest. When there was an incident in a fort in Northern Afghanistan called Kala-i-Jangi, where several hundred prisoners were captured, and they had managed to smuggle some weapons in them, and they tried to fight back against their captors. The U.S. was then called in to bomb the hell out of the place, and these people were bombed for a week and flooded and electrocuted, and the survivors came out after a week, and most of the ones who survived ended up in Guantanamo. But Dostum brought these two mullahs along to try and get them to negotiate with the prisoners, and they refused. Now, I don't know whether it was at that point that that Dostum decided to hand them over to the Americans. Maybe he didn't. Maybe what happened is that at some point down the line, the Americans said, "Hey, you've got these two Taliban guys, and we want them."
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear, you know. But I think I think these are the two who most obviously have allegations against them, which are monstrous. The problem is that, you know, these are not issues that the U.S. was in a position to prosecute for. You know, Maurice Davis told Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! That yesterday or the day before. She said, look, you know, when we were looking at the cases of people that we could prosecute in Guantanamo, and we looked at dozens and dozens of prisoners who we thought we might be able to build a case against, you know, that didn't really work out. But he said these guys' names never came up, you know. The shame on America is that if they had a couple of guys who had been involved in genocide, essentially, then, you know, they should have been handed over to people who would have been able to prosecute them. But guess what? That would have been the International Criminal Court. And guess what? The United States isn't interested in signing up to the International Criminal Court.
Right.
And why would that be? Well, it might end up being that their leaders would be summoned to the International Criminal Court. So, you know, that's a pretty sad thing. I mean, you know, I have looked at the stories, guys, and, you know, what they were doing, you know, when this story was announced, you know, John McCain said these guys are the worst murderers in history or something, some ridiculous thing. He was then criticized by John Kerry, and then he came back and said they killed Americans. There is no evidence that they killed Americans. These right. guys were Taliban fighting other Afghans in Afghanistan, and there was a short window after the U.S. invaded where, you know, they were there fighting back against the Americans because, hey, you know, the situation had changed. But fundamentally, everything that they did was in an Afghan context and not in any other way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's these two guys. The other ones, I have to say, Peter, you know, one of them appears to have... He was the deputy deputy guy for intelligence with the Taliban, I believe. But from what I've seen of his story, he was a kind of glorified clerk. I don't think you know, he was anybody particularly significant. There's a guy called Kerula Kerkwa, who was the he was the governor of the western province of Herat. So, there are allegations of human rights abuses in his past as well. But generally, I think, you know, the time before his capture, he's working as a, you know, as a Taliban, a senior Taliban official. He's not on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy, he seems to be somebody who was a lower level leader in eastern Afghanistan. And he seems to have been included in the package because he was involved with the Haqqani network. So this is Gulbuddin Haqqani, who's a Taliban-affiliated warlord in eastern Afghanistan. And it's the Haqqani network that was holding Bo Bergdahl for all these years. Mm-hmm. Not the Taliban. It's the Taliban-affiliated Haqqani network. So he appears to be included as a kind of, to be something for the Haqqani network to get out of it rather than the Taliban to get.
And Anand Gopal indicated that Kerkwa, is that how it said?
Yeah.
Kerkwa and Nabi, both were delivered on the basis of false accusations, and that Nabi had been some sort of intermediary between the Haqqani network and the CIA in the early days of the U.S. invasion.
Right. Well... Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really great that you talked to Anand because he's done some fantastic work on the Afghans. I'm very much looking forward to reading his book. He's sending me a copy as we speak. I'm hoping it arrives with me very soon because we met here, and you know, he'd looked at my research a lot. He was really going into depth into the story of, you know, of the Afghans. I mean, not just his broad narrative in his book of how, as he put it to me, how America snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. You know, America was winning at the very beginning, and then, hey, you should have gone home, guys. But anyway, you know, he's done such a lot of work on the specifics of the prisoners who ended up in Guantanamo. And, you know, I think we're already getting a little bit more detail here, Peter, aren't we, about people who tried to change sides? Well, that's interesting. Why would they not be allowed to do that? Murky stories about well, who exactly were they working with? You know, it could well be that you've got a guy there who's being, you know, called one of the worst murderers in history by John McCain, who was actually working with the CIA. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
That could well turn out to be the case.
Right. And Andy, before we wrap up, I must ask the current status of Shaker Amer. And, you know, we saw a very powerful piece from Clive Stafford Smith earlier this week where Shaker Amer apparently still has his sense of humor and was suggesting that, you know, he'd like to plead guilty to have cooked a meal for Osama bin Laden or something like that because declaring his innocence has left him in limbo at Guantanamo, uncharged, untried, and no prospect of release.
Yeah, well, you know, like all the other men who have been cleared for release, actually, Peter, and, you know, I'm no clearer than I've ever been on why it is that the sole British prisoner in Guantanamo isn't released when the British government claims that it wants him back. You know, I think we're pretty clear now on what the foot dragging is on the US end, but, you know, we're not at the British end. Whenever it's raised here, we're told that they're absolutely doing their utmost. They're clearly not doing their utmost because if, you know, if David Cameron picked up the phone and said, listen, Barak, it's extremely important to me. But, you know, it isn't. There isn't a massive campaign ongoing in the UK for Shaker Amer, unfortunately.
Well, as we're speaking, the president is visiting with Cameron around the G7 conference.
Right, right. Well, will they mention it? I don't know. I mean, you know, last year, you know, the prime minister apparently did mention it, you know, actually, you know, face-to-face with President Obama said, hey, how about that Shaka Armour guy? Mm-hmm. Did he do that? I don't know. But, you know, he's not being released. But all of the guys in Guantanamo, you know, especially all of those who have been cleared for release, who, you know, to be put in that position, it's because, you know, multiple review processes essentially have led to a point where people have said, look, this guy does not pose a significant threat to the United States. There is no point in us carrying on holding him. And yet they are stuck there because, as Shaka Armour says, you know, they could. It turns out that, you know, if they'd only been in the corner of the compound with the people who, you know, every now and then used to meet with Osama bin Laden, you know, like the Sudanese guy. There was a Sudanese guy who used to cook. He didn't cook for Osama bin Laden or even Al-Qaeda. He cooked for people who were affiliated with them, you know.
He provided material support to affiliates of... Oh, Andy, what a...
But, you know,
what
I
a...
Mean, the,
go ahead.
The other thing we should look at is, you know, of all these cleared prisoners, there are four Afghans. There are 12 Afghans now in Guantanamo. And, you know, and I think that nearly all of them are people who are utterly insignificant. There's a couple of guys that they brought in late who they claim are significant. But most of these people are nobodies. Now, only four of the 12 have actually been cleared for release. But how gutting is it for those guys? I mean, these are real nobodies. How gutting is it for those guys that are sitting there just going like, well, what does it take? You know, it's disgraceful. And I know from what Shaka was saying, I know the stories. You know, one of these guys was, because some of the Afghans were previously, under Bush, they were put forward for military commission trials, you know, with really no case to be made against them. But I know that in recent years, some of these people, you know, the trials have drifted out of view. And some of them have been approached by prosecutors saying, give us something that we can use and we'll sort out a plea deal for you and get you out of here. And you have had some of these guys going, if only I could help you.
Yeah.
I know nothing. There is nothing I can give you that you can reach a plea deal with me about, because these people had no involvement with anybody in any kind of wrongdoing. It really is depressing. I mean, you know, we, those of us who care, Peter, and I know you know that there are many of us. We're a disparate group of people who care. We're outnumbered by the people who are indifferent, by the people who have bought the propaganda over the last 12 years. But there are many of us who know that this is wrong. And it is extremely disheartening as we have a detailed conversation like this about all the idiocy that's going on. But at the bottom of it all are a bunch of guys sitting in Guantanamo who are nobodies. I mean, they are nobody. And yet, you know, they're imprisoned there. They've been there for 12 years. We can't see an end to their imprisonment, and nor can they, because they've become a game of cynical game of political football for people who all ought to be ashamed of themselves. Lawmakers, political pundits, people in the media who are treating it as some kind of game when it really isn't.
Very well said, Andy. Thank you for your long-term and ongoing commitment to exposing the barbaric prison at Guantanamo Bay, and I hope that we can share a moment when it's closed sometime. And we continue with the second segment of our special podcast update on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Andy Worthington updated us on quite a bit, and joining us now is attorney John Eisenberg. Regular listeners to the Peter B. Collins podcast will remember the many conversations we've had with John about his handling of the very important Al-Haramain case, which resulted in a finding that the government conducted illegal wiretapping. It was a very important case, and John offered us quite a bit of insight into how that occurred. He is now representing individuals who are held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And, John, I want to welcome you back to the program today.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you.
You talked with us last fall about the legal issues that arise from the hunger strikes that prisoners elect to embark on. And we put it in the context that it is the only kind of speech or expression that is available to them to protest their continuing confinement without charge or trial under U.S. government control. Give us your own view about the nature of these hunger strikes and the right of an individual and the extent to which it's codified into law or treaties to decline to accept sustenance.
These prisoners have virtually no personal autonomy at all. Every aspect of their lives, every minute of their lives is under the exclusive and unfettered control of the authorities at Guantanamo Bay. Not surprisingly, they're very upset about the fact that they've been detained indefinitely without trial, some of them for as long as 12 years. And since early last year, quite a few of them have been expressing their displeasure in the only way available to them, by refusing to eat, by hunger striking.
Mm-hmm.
That's their only way of speaking out against their indefinite detention. And so since February so of 2013, as many as well over 100 have been on hunger strike, as many as 45 or so have been force-fed. You don't hear much about the hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay these days because the government has shut off all flow of information coming from there to the public. Many people I know are surprised to hear that the hunger strike is still going on, but indeed it is. There are perhaps 36 hunger striking right now, perhaps 18 or so of them being force-fed. It's hard to know the precise numbers because the only access we have to information is from our own clients. On the rare occasions we're able to reach them on the telephone or speak to them in person.
And in fact, isn't the Defense Department kind of playing with the numbers and the definition of who is on a hunger strike? And I understand that more recently they've taken to only describing it as a hunger strike if it reaches the point where they move to force feeding. And so they're kind of massaging the numbers or playing games with the stats. Is that fair to say?
Well, worse than that, they're pretending that there's no hunger strike at all. They no longer will officially use the phrase hunger strike. They now call what's been going on at Guantanamo Bay a non-religious fast. And they have rewritten their protocols to address non-religious fasting.
Jesus.
The hunger strike was so effective last year that the government decided to take a two-pronged approach to combating it. Three-pronged, really. First prong, pretend it's not happening. Call it something else, non-religious fasting. Second prong, cut off all flow of information, official information at least, about it. The third prong, make hunger striking so painful, so physically painful to the hunger strikers that they give it up. And that's, that third prong is what I've been especially focusing on in the litigation I've been doing with Reprieve, which is a human rights charity in England, challenging the force feeding.
And John, when you talk about the third prong here, the two critical aspects are what they call cell extractions, where they physically and sometimes violently remove the prisoners from their cells and strip search them and other processes that we would find inhuman or at least highly invasive. And then instead of leaving a feeding tube in on an ongoing basis, they will insert and remove the tubes as often as twice a day. And I once explained to you that after a car accident, I was subject to the insertion of a feeding tube, and it's the most excruciating thing I've ever experienced. And so they intentionally insert and remove the tubes frequently, which makes this whole process that much more unbearable.
Yes, indeed. Here's how it normally happens. For most detainees, not for all, a few of the sickest are treated a little bit differently. But for most of the detainees, it starts with what they call a forcible cell extraction, or FCE in government lingo. What that means is a team of six very large guards wearing special equipment storm the man's cell, knock him to the ground, tie him up. We've had reports of men being choked during the process, and drag him off to a restraint chair. This is a specially made chair, which the detainees commonly refer to as the torture chair, in which they're strapped down at their feet, stomach, hands, chest. Their heads are held by the guard staff. Often a mask is put over their mouth. And then a feeding tube is inserted through the nose down into the stomach. They're force-fed a certain amount of liquid nutrient, probably with water mixed in it, in a set period of time, which I'll talk about in a minute. Then the feeding tube is removed. They're taken back to their cells. So a number of really awful things are going on here. They're being beaten up in the forcible cell extractions. The tube is being removed and reinserted usually twice a day, which is definitely not in conformance with customary medical practice. People who have long-term nasogastric feeding tubes have the tubes remain in place for anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks usually, and then it's switched to the other nostril. For the very, very reason you mentioned earlier, it can really hurt going in. Not just going in, going through the nose and down into the stomach, but one of our clients, Mr. Diab, reported to me over the weekend that when a force feeding was done to him last week, the nurse kept pushing on the feeding tube after it got into his stomach. So the tube, which has a metal tip, was banging up against the interior of his stomach, which hurt quite a bit, not surprisingly. Yeah. They frequently bleed from the nose when this is done because, yes, it hurts when it's done once, but imagine it having it done to you twice a day, day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out. We have one client, Mr. Hassan, who has been force-fed for 7 years. He has had feeding tubes put down his nose into his throat and removed some 5,000 times, which is really hard to believe. Now, there's another thing going on here, which I find very disturbing. It's not done to everybody, but we have had reports of it being done to some, which is that the force feeding is being done too quickly in greater quantities appropriate. We've had reports of as much as 2,300 milliliters of nutrient in water, which is about two-thirds of a gallon, being force-fed in as little as 15 or 20 minutes.
Wow.
Which is, one of our expert witnesses has reported that, in his view, that amount of force-feeding in that period of time is effectively water torture. Not waterboarding. Waterboarding is when water is dripped over a cloth into the mouth and gives you a choking sensation.
Mm-hmm.
This is called pumping. It's a different form of water torture. It's not waterboarding or what's called commonly choking. It's called pumping, where a large quantity of fluid is pumped into the stomach and causes the stomach to distend and hurt quite a bit. It's something the Japanese Imperial Army did to U.S. and Allied soldiers during World War II. I just learned over the weekend, again in my phone call with Mr. Diab, that when they force feed him, they've been cinching the strap at his stomach too tightly, so that when the fluid goes in and distends his stomach, it's pushed against a strap, and that hurts him. And he asks them to loosen the strap, and they refuse. But one thing I can I can't say for certain how many detainees have been subjected to this form of water torture, but I can tell you for sure that tubes are being removed after every feeding, which is just outrageous.
And, John, similar to the way that your legal team came into custody of the evidence that the FBI had wiretapped your clients in the Al Haramain case, you recently learned that there are videotapes of the cell extractions and the force feedings, and these have now become subject of a court order under Judge Kessler.
Yes, we have known for quite some time, it's been public knowledge, that the authorities at Guantanamo Bay videotape the forcible cell extractions. Now, we only knew that they were videotaping those. We did not know that they were videotaping any of the force feedings themselves. When I started to do discovery in this case, just a few weeks ago, in the Diab case I'm referring to specifically, and I asked for production of the forcible cell extraction videotapes, the thought occurred to me that there might be the odd tape here or there where they didn't turn the camera off and maybe picked up one or two force feedings. So I asked the government not just for videotapes of forcible cell extractions. I also asked for videotapes of any force feedings. The response I got from the government attorney was really interesting. And this, by the way, is an email. And we are required by local rule in the district court to confer, whether by email or over telephone, before any motion is filed. And I was anticipating having to file a motion to compel discovery. So I am now emailing the government attorney, and he has to respond to me. That's just the way, that's how it's done. He's not just being nice, mm-hmm. responding to my emails. So when I asked him for any videotapes of force feedings as well as forcible cell extractions, he responded, as a matter of policy, the Department of Defense does not videotape force feedings. And I thought about that for a few minutes and went up, got a cup of coffee, sat back down on my computer, and responded to government counsel. Okay, fine. As a matter of policy, I understand. They don't do it as a matter of policy. How about in practice? Do they do it? Have they ever done it? Was it ever policy? And he emailed back to me, said, I'll get back to you. And a day later, he did get back to me, and he said, well, you know, yeah, there are a few. And about a week later, we were in court before Judge Kessler, and the government attorney said, well, actually, there's 34 of them. And that's what she has ordered the government to produce, 34 videotapes of force feedings of this particular detainee. I'm seeking a similar production for two other detainees named Hassan and Rabbani.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the specific case of Abu Wael Diab, spelled D-H-I-A-B. He is a Syrian national who has been held for 12 years or more at Guantanamo Bay, and he has been cleared for release. And he has been offered a new home in Uruguay.
I cannot confirm or deny that. I can only tell you that you're repeating what's been reported in the papers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So just to make that clear, I
do understand the
we're
Alice.
Not going there.
I understand the Alice in Wonderland world that you must observe the rules of. And so I won't ask you to confirm or deny that, but for the information of our listeners, that is what is available in news accounts regarding Mr. Diab. And so in the current situation, he appears to be expressing his outrage and despondence at the failure to release him. And the hunger strike, as we discussed, is the only method available to him to express that. And so you have brought his case before Judge Gladys Kessler, who, again, based on news accounts, appears to be very sincerely wrestling and deeply troubled by the issues that are before her. So she issued one ruling which ordered the government to stop the force feeding of Mr. Diab up to a certain date. And then a couple of days before that date, she rescinded the order, saying that she was concerned that he actually might die from his hunger strike and that this created a Hobson's choice for her. Go ahead and expand a little bit on the issues before the court and the commentary that you have heard from Judge Kessler.
Well, some of this I, again, have to be very circumspect with because some of this was addressed at the May 21st hearing in closed session.
Okay.
And I'd have to think long and hard about how much detail I can give about that. Some of what transpired at that closed session in court was reported on, was mentioned in one of Judge Kessler's orders, but some of it still is not public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will only say this. Yes, Judge Kessler was extremely concerned for Mr. Diab's health, and she expressed her concern in her orders last, it was, I guess, about 2 weeks ago. Subsequently, I had two telephone calls with Mr. Diab, one about 10 days ago and one this past Sunday. And during those telephone calls, Mr. Diab made it clear to me to tell the judge in no uncertain terms that he is not at imminent risk of death or serious bodily injury, that he has been taking fluids on a regular basis. He, in fact, has been taking food on occasion. Indeed, on one occasion last week, last Friday, after he had suffered two very, very brutal forcible cell extractions and force feedings, he decided he wanted to eat dinner that evening so he wouldn't have to go through another one. And he did, in fact, eat, and they did it to him anyway.
Wow.
So,
and John, I read the three-page order from Judge Kessler where she initially ordered them to stop force-feeding him, and the order included a very specific line that they should stop the forcible cell extractions.
I believe what she wanted was humane treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that when she lifted her TRO out of concern for his life, she expected that the force feeding she was allowing to resume would be done as humanely as possible, as any civilized government would do, as a general proposition, and specifically during the course of judicial oversight. I believe that when she allowed the force feeding to resume, she took it on faith. She didn't. I mean, this is just how what I'm reading into her decision.
Mm-hmm.
She took it on faith that the government would be reasonable about this, and they haven't been, which is what we learned on Sunday when I spoke to Mr. Diab. They haven't been at all. They've been as brutal as ever.
And has there been any further reaction from Judge Kessler in open session that you can relay to us?
No, we have. Our next court date is June 18th, and I cannot predict what might happen between now and then. There are several outstanding motions in the case, but really right now the ball's in Judge Kessler's court.
And let me just read from this news account, Byline Charlie Savage, May 23rd, New York Times. Judge Kessler had asked the military to negotiate a compromise over its procedures with the detainee and his representatives, that's you, while the litigation unfolded. She wrote that Diab had asked to be fed at the base hospital without being strapped into the restraint chair and without having the feeding tube reinserted, then removed for each cycle, sparing him, quote, the agony of that procedure. The article continues, if he could have been fed in that manner to prevent him from committing suicide by starvation, quote, it would have then been possible to litigate his plea to enjoin certain practices used in his force feeding in a civilized and legally appropriate manner, she wrote. And a further quote from the judge, the Department of Defense refused to make these compromises. Now, this appears to be almost a separation of powers issue, John, where the executive branch, the military here, is defying at least the spirit of the court order from Judge Kessler.
I believe that is true. I believe that the government, and by that I'm sorry to say the Obama administration, the Department of Defense, and the authorities at Guantanamo Bay do not recognize Judge Kessler's authority to do anything, to tell them what to do or how to do it. And they, indeed, I believe, are defying her. And she now needs to make a really, really difficult decision, which is what to do about it. I think all three branches of our government at all times try to avoid clashes between the three. It's a delicate balance that our Constitution set up. I guess literally checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be delicate. And when one branch of government oversteps its authority, it can be very dicey what the other branch or the other branches of government might decide to do about it. So I believe, I don't believe, I know, as a lawyer, that the United States has a time-honored tradition in litigation of avoiding clashes between the three branches of government if they can be avoided. In my view, at this point, it has gotten to the extent that it cannot be avoided. And I believe Judge Kessler has been very cautious in taking an appropriately minimalist approach in the short term in order to allow the government to do the right thing and stop literally torturing these men. I don't believe they're going to stop, and I believe Judge Kessler is going to have to wrestle with a really difficult decision, which is, now what do I do? Mm-hmm. What do I do about this now? And I feel for her. I really do. I mean, if you read her opinion, you can see she really was agonizing. She understood quite well, I believe, what she was consigning Mr. Diab to when she lifted the TRO, or what she was potentially consigning him to. And I think that's a better way of putting it, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was hoping against hope that out of her great concern for his well-being, concern which turned out to be, I can't say unnecessary, but he is okay. Out of her great concern for his well-being, again, I think she wanted to take it on faith that he would not be abused, he would not be tortured as a result of her actions. And that's not how it's gone down, which is really sad. So she has another tough choice to make.
And in a broader sense, John, we now have a growing class of anguished judges in this country who are caught between their interpretation of the law. We have Judge Lynn Windmill in Idaho, who is begging the Supreme Court to overturn a ruling that he issued this week on the NSA's metadata collection program. Even Judge Reggie Walton, the past presiding judge of the FISA court, has complained that he can't get the truth out of the NSA and that the courts are not being properly respected. And the denial of appeals by the Supreme Court leave federal trial court judges and some of the lower appeals court judges in very difficult positions.
I think many judges, across many federal judges across the country, like Judge Kessler, would prefer not to have to do battle with the executive branch. And the courts have been deferring for a very long time. They have been waiting, particularly the D.C. courts, the D.C. Circuit Court and the D.C. Trial Courts, the District Court. They've been very, very, very patient in waiting for President Obama to take a huge load of cases off their hands and release the 75-some-odd detainees who have been cleared for release. And I imagine they're getting pretty frustrated with it, and you're seeing that across the board. You saw that from Judge Von Walker in the Al-Haramain case.
Mm-hmm.
Is the judges try to be reasonable. They try to forge a compromise. They practically beg the government to sit down with the opposing counsel and work out a way of avoiding this clash of government power. And the Department of Justice and the White House just say, no, we're not going to do it. We don't even recognize your legitimacy. And so, you know, I think that the patience of the judiciary in general is being sorely tested and is wearing thin.
John, in the first segment of this podcast, we spoke to journalist Andy Worthington from London. And we discussed how the distraction of the trade of five Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has created this new emotional distraction. And that we also see that Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who under the restrictions imposed by the Congress, has the sole authority to issue waivers for prisoners to be released from Guantanamo, and that the White House is now leaning on Hagel to follow through. We saw the report of a letter from National Security Advisor Susan Rice to the Secretary of Defense, pretty terse in demanding that he report to the White House every 2 weeks on any progress toward releasing individuals from Guantanamo. And he seemed to arch his back and say, I'm going to take my time with this. And I find that to be obscene against the case of your client, Mr. Diab, cleared for release for more than 4 years now, languishing there without charge or trial or prospect of either, and this whole legal issue could be dispose of it from their point of view without setting some precedent, simply by following through and releasing this man. And these various aspects that I just described are very troubling, and it appears that the Bergdahl case is going to complicate them even further.
That could be. I don't know. It remains to be seen what the specifics are of the Bergdahl case that prompted President Obama to act as he did without notifying Congress beforehand. I've seen reports just today that Sergeant Bergdahl was gravely ill or feared to be gravely ill and required immediate action. There's been a lot of ink spilled over how the Bergdahl situation might affect the remaining detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and I don't want to contribute to that spillage.
But that's fine.
I will say this. Here's something I don't understand. Who's in charge? If Chuck Hagel is balking at signing off on the release of Guantanamo Bay detainees to Uruguay, as been reported in the press, and if President Obama is now leaning on him to sign off and let these guys go through Susan Rice, well, who's in charge here? The president, the commander-in-chief, or the secretary of defense? And if Obama cannot control this situation, why is that? And this is a question I ask myself frequently in the past few years, having done a lot of litigation in this field now, Guantanamo Bay and Al Haramain, where it was wiretapping. Is the problem that President Obama is too weak, or is the problem that the Department of Defense and the Pentagon and the intelligence community are too strong, or is it some of both? But I don't understand, and I question over and over again, why doesn't President Obama just step in, take charge, and put out some orders to people to do stuff? Or as he put it in the State of the Union address, let's get it done. Let's get it done. Now, here's where I think that resonates the most with me. The force feeding. The brutal way in which it is being done. Now, he has absolute unfettered power to stop that. He doesn't need Chuck Hagel's sign-off on that. Assuming he feels he needs Hagel to sign off on release, okay. He doesn't need Hagel to sign off on treating these guys humanely. He is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He can order the government. He could have ordered the government to, after the hearing on May 21st, the authorities at JTF Gitmo at Guantanamo Bay, he could have simply ordered them to accept the compromise that we had proposed, which is, or was, that Mr. Diab be hospitalized, the feeding tube be left in, not removed and reinserted twice a day, and that he not be forcibly removed from his cell during the pendency of this litigation. Obama could simply have ordered that compromise to be accepted. Why didn't he? Is he powerless? I mean, I wish that I could ask the president publicly. I wish somebody would ask him publicly, why don't you just step in and order that it be done humanely? That's greatly baffling to me. Is he just not want to see what's going on? Is he afraid that the Department of the Pentagon, that the authorities at JTF Gitmo will just simply say, you can't tell us what to do? I mean, I gotta wonder.
Yeah. Well, those are very important questions, John, and maybe we should, you know, roll our credit cards together, go to a fundraiser, and then we could actually talk to the president.
I'm not making any money this year. I can't afford to go to an Obama fundraiser. I'm spending all my time on Guantanamo Bay litigation.
And John, one of the ironies that I talked with Andy Worthington about is that here we have members of Congress of both parties trying to micromanage retroactively this prisoner swap. And yet they have no reaction to the president's announcement less than a week ago that we're going to be staying in Afghanistan longer than he promised. There is no reaction to his claimed ability to select individuals, including American citizens, as the targets of fatal drone strikes. And while there was a little altercation before the confirmation of an appeals court judge recently who had written the opinions at the Office of Legal Counsel, we've been promised that a scrubbed version of those memos will finally be made available. You know, John McCain and the others in Congress who are hopping mad about this are not focusing on anything else except scoring political points. And I think there are critical issues that, you know, should be discussed about the president's recent pronouncements and actions. But instead, they're going deep on a matter that I guess they think will resonate with the electoral base this fall.
Well, something I find really interesting, I saw a report, I believe yesterday, that Lindsey Graham has said that if Obama releases any more detainees without giving 30 days notice to Congress, that he will consider impeachment. Now, President Obama's justification for releasing the five Taliban detainees, so-called Taliban in any case, detainees, without giving prior notice to Congress, is that that portion of the National Defense Authorization Act requiring notice was unconstitutional. And when he signed the act, he issued a signing statement saying, I'm not going to follow this particular part of it because it infringes on my exclusive authority as the president. So effectively, President Obama seems to be embracing President Bush's theory of the unitary executive, the executive who has exclusive power over national security issues and can disregard an act of Congress in the name of national security. When Bush did it, which was one of the so-called legal underpinnings of warrantless wiretapping, when Bush did it, the Republicans embraced it. Now that Obama's doing it, the Republicans are talking about impeaching him for it. And it's a crazy world. I spent 7 years litigating Al-Haramain, challenging the notion of the president having the power to disregard an act of Congress, challenging that, and now the Republicans seem to be getting on board with me.
Well, we do have strange bedfellows. The flip side of that is that the civil liberties groups who were outraged over Bush's wiretapping seem remarkably comfortable with it under Obama.
I think they don't know what to do. Not all of them. Certainly not the ACLU. Certainly not the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Agreed.
But I think a lot of people are just stunned from 6 years, five and a half years of just amazing conduct by President Obama, from embracing warrantless wiretapping to drone strikes to what he's allowed the National Security Agency to become. I think everybody's punch drunk.
Yeah.
And some are so disheartened that they don't bother speaking up anymore. Some are in complete denial as to what's been happening, and we'll defend this president no matter what. And then there's some like us.
Yeah.
And who keep fighting. Oh.
Well, John, just one other aspect of the Guantanamo force feeding situation I had meant to raise a little earlier is that Jason Leopold has reported over the last couple of days that the Defense Department is bragging about how compliant force feeding detainees are now given the option to watch movies or play video games while they are being force-fed. What's your comment on that?
Well, that's actually only a small number of force feeders. I believe it's around five of them. There are five long-term force feeders who have been on hunger strike for years, who have been force-fed for years, who are extremely weak, who are being treated specially since last November, I believe. And it's just those five that are force-fed in more comfortable chairs and given videotapes, access to videos to watch.
Mm-hmm.
As I told Mr. Leopold, if it's such a Disneyland kind of experience being force-fed at Guantanamo Bay, you would expect the government to be eager to release the videotapes showing it. Somehow I don't think it'll be a Disney movie. But that's just a small number of detainees. Mr. Diab is not among that number.
Mm-hmm.
He is being FCE'd, forcible cell extraction. He is being strapped to a restraint chair. He is being brutally mistreated. And, you know, this small group of five or so, I don't think they're any happier about what's happening to them than Mr. Diab is. I think the difference with them is that they're quite ill.
And, John, finally, is there any international reaction that you're picking up that's not reported in the American media? Are there advocates from other countries who have joined, you know, beyond Reprieve, the British charity you referred to? Is there any international consensus of outrage at these events at Guantanamo?
Well, certainly the international medical community has spoken out against force feeding. That's the World Medical Association. Their canons forbid force feeding of prisoners. I have seen a great deal of reporting about what's happening at Guantanamo in England and Europe, specifically Great Britain, France, Switzerland, Italy. Sometime last week, one of the Guantanamo Bay habeas attorneys forwarded me a link to an Italian television news segment reporting on the force feeding at Guantanamo Bay, and I proceeded to watch about a five or so minute counting entirely in Italian, which I studied once upon a time, but I didn't understand a word they were saying recently, actually. Interestingly enough, Russia TV has covered it extensively.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose not surprisingly. We shouldn't be surprised that the Russian government would want to use every opportunity to portray the United States in an unflattering light, and we're certainly giving them the opportunity.
Indeed. Well, John, thank you for your hard work on these cases and for fighting for the rights that every American thinks should be in place. And we'll talk to you down the road, and I hope you do prevail in the proceedings with Judge Kessler.
Thanks, and it was great talking to you. I appreciate it.
John Eisenberg here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this package of in-depth interviews. I appreciate your feedback and comments. The email is peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.